How old were you when you enlisted?
I was 20 when I enlisted.
20, okay.
I could hear the draft board coming up behind me, so I joined the Air Force because I didn't think they shot at airmen.
You really thought that?
Oh, really? Well, I thought that it was a safer place to be. One teacher we had was thoroughly convinced that we were going to be in atomic war and we were all going to die. And I picked that up, and I was afraid of war. Hmm. It scared me. I thought, if I go to war, I'll die.
How prominent was that emotion? I mean, did you think 100% that's what's going to happen?
Well, I grew up during duck and cover days, and when I would go somewhere, I never argued with my teacher. When I would go somewhere, I would look for a place to hide when the bomb went off. I grew up that way, and I always thought war meant you die. Mm-hmm. So when they handed me orders to Vietnam, I thought they handed me orders to go get killed.
Did you know when you enlisted that you would go to Vietnam? Because this was in 64, wasn't it?
This was 64. It was before many people were going to Vietnam. They dragged me in before they before they've told me what it was all about, I guess. But
the draft board, you knew they were coming, so you decided, I'll go ahead and enlist. I can pick where I'll be, where you think you'll be the safest.
Right.
Did you have any idea of where you'd go? I mean, did you?
Not where I'd go. I knew I was had some mechanical training, and I would probably go into automotive mechanics. And that's where they put me until I went to Vietnam. And then they actually moved me into what they called 463L maintenance, which was repairing forklifts and cargo loaders on the flight line.
And tell me about when you received the orders that you were going to Vietnam. What was the most prominent emotion that came over you?
Well, they said I was white, so I lost all color. When they told me I was going to Vietnam, I heard, we're sending you to die. And so the first few hours until I was able to have a couple drinks and stop back and think about it. And then, of course, you deal with it after that. But that first shock was just something else because I was no hero.
You didn't feel like it at the time. Do you feel like one now?
No. I did what I was supposed to, and I stood up when I had to. But you know, everybody did that. And most people did that.
And what year was it that you were sent to Vietnam?
I went in 67, served 67, 68.
So 68, you were within the Tet Offensive then?
Yes. As a matter of fact, I spent a few days in Khe Sanh during the Tet Offensive, which wasn't my idea either, but they shot at you a lot up there.
But I imagine that's everywhere in that country at that time.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But Khe Sanh was just a little place that they were really serious about taking, so that was the hot spot.
Mm. Tell me what it was like being over there. I mean, what kind of duties you had as an airman, or were you a mechanic primarily?
Well, it was my rank was airman and then buck sergeant. They called it for a while. Now I'm not sure what they designated as now, but we worked 12 hours a day, 7 days a week in outdoors and in open lean-to type shops, and repaired the cargo handling equipment. When I went over there, I was went over as an auto mechanic. And fortunately, they needed people working on the 463L equipment. So I was the newest guy there, so they sent me over to work there. And the guys that were just straight automotive mechanics stayed in one shop for the whole year, working 12 hours a day, 6 days a week, 7 days a week. We traveled around to the small detachments all over I Corps and parts of 2 Corps. So we got some breaks while we were traveling, and also we got to see a little of the country. So I was really fortunate to get transferred.
When you see movies on Vietnam, I'm thinking of, you know, Forrest Gump and such like that. It's battle all the time almost, and there's always someone waiting to jump out and shoot at you. Is that real? Is that how it was?
On where I was at, which was on detachments or Da Nang, there would be rocket attacks once, you know, just maybe two or three a month. And other than that, it was just hard work. You were always anticipating a rocket attack, and then during Tet, they tried to get onto the bases. And so there was a lot of hand-to-hand there. But there again, the Air Force was there to supply. We didn't have to go out and stand on the line and protect the place. So we pretty much stayed within it. I very seldom got shot at with rifle fire. The rockets and mortars would come fairly close. But I never saw anybody that was after me.
So we just heard a cannon go off. Do those kind of noises bother you at all?
They did at first, but not badly. I came through a lot better off than a lot of the guys. And I really think part of it was I was so sure that it was the end of the line for me when I went to war, that the relief, you know, every day that I stayed alive was good, even when the ugly things happened. They didn't affect me as much as the people that went over feeling invincible.
I'm curious about that mindset that you have, because I would think that maybe it's a little more maybe morbid, that you're like, well, I'm going to die, I'll be more reckless. I mean, was that the case, or were you really protective of your life?
No,
still?
I was protective. I didn't really want to go, and I thought I would take the best chance. It was going to be hard to get me, but no, I went over there just thinking I was going to do my best, but I probably wouldn't make it, and maybe it made me more alert sometimes. Maybe, I don't know, but mostly mentally, it was, I think, the best way to be, that short fear and then getting used to it rather than the long fear and the night sweats for years afterwards.
So do you think, if you could see that teacher again, I'm sure that the teacher has passed on possibly by now, would you say thank you, or why did you do that to me? Put that in your mind that you're going to die.
I don't think I could have said anything to her. She was doing the best she could, unfortunately, and for a lot of the people that were with me, it probably didn't affect them that way. But my mindset, what I thought, you know, it just was wrong for me. But no, she was doing her best, and she was thoroughly convinced that we were all going to die. So couldn't change her mind. I mean, it wasn't her fault.
Mm-hmm. She had picked it up somewhere, obviously.
Right.
And you grew up in Wagner, South Dakota.
Right.
Tell me about what your life was like before you went into Vietnam, or before you enlisted even, when you were 20 years old.
Well, I grew up on a farm and was a fairly typical farm kid. But I was one with a lot of allergies, so it was not fun all the time. And went through one-room school for the eighth grades and then into town for high school. Nothing spectacular about my upbringing, you know. And then I went off to a trade school, what they call trade school. Now Technical Institute would be what it would be for automotive mechanics, and then worked at that until I realized that it was time for me to enlist, so I didn't get drafted.
Did you have a lot of friends around you doing the same thing, or were they waiting to see if they might be drafted, or what was it like in your town of Wagner?
Well, I was 20. A lot of them had already gone into the service. I was one of the last ones around that didn't either move away from, you know, everybody moved away from small towns for a while. A lot of them came back, but I was one of the few that was back. It was around there at the time, so I wasn't really watching the rest of them.
Did you have any brothers or sisters?
Yes, my sister was a year older than me, and my brother was 16 years younger than me. So I didn't. I knew him as a little kid before I went, you mm-hmm. know, but.
Do you remember what it was like, maybe particularly for your mom, when you were leaving for Vietnam?
They never showed me what they were really thinking. I never really showed them. But then when I went to Vietnam, I told them a lot of lies. You know, I would tell them, I'd write a letter home saying, if you heard Da Nang got hit, that was clear over by the flight line. We're back where we're at. It doesn't get much. So that was a lie. I was 100 yards off the flight line, and the doors blew open on the bunker, or on the hut one day during a rocket attack. But we didn't tell them that. They didn't know I'd been to Khe Sanh, and they didn't know I was on a C-130 that got shot up. They learned all that after I came home. I just didn't see any reason to worry them.
How often did you write home?
That started out weekly and ended up probably monthly. You know, as time went on, it was different. I didn't write or receive many letters the last few months, because a lot of it was same stuff, and especially when you weren't telling the truth, and busy, and you just kind of drift away while you're there.
I wonder if your parents believed you.
About
the letters, the lies you're saying about what was really happening.
They never did tell me whether they did or not. You know, I told them, I said, a lot of what was in the letters just wasn't fact, and I gave them a couple examples, and they never said anything. Mom saved all my letters, and I got those, and I read them, and that didn't make sense. You know, that didn't have anything to do with what I was doing. But no, it never really talked a lot about it. You know, stories and what was going on and all, but not about emotions. You know, that was in a time when you didn't talk a lot of that. So,
do you mean in your letters they didn't have a lot of emotions in them, or
no,
more when you came back?
Well, both. I mean, it was, I shouldn't say not emotions, but more unspoken type. You know, we didn't say, boy, I felt this way and I felt that way, you know.
Would you say that fear was your most prominent emotion that you had there? That you were maybe going back to that, you thought you were going to die?
No, interest. I always have been fascinated by how people function and think. And to see the levels that you can move to and function was just amazing. I've talked about that with other people that are going through things like cancer or anything else. People say, I couldn't handle that. They say, you have no idea what you can handle. You handle things as they come up. When you're not called upon to handle the situation, you don't realize it. You know, the people that go into hospitals, before you've been in a hospital, you can never picture yourself laid up in a hospital, but you just go through it. And it was the same with Vietnam. You just do what's called on you, and you have no concept of what's going to be called on you until you're called. And then you just find out that you're capable of much more.
Give me one example or a situation where you realized yourself that you're capable of more than you ever thought.
I didn't really notice it in myself, I don't think. I mean, I knew I was coping, but there was no one thing. It would be, you just watch people come over and mature, you know, then you hear people, the new people say, I couldn't do this or I couldn't do that, and pretty soon they're doing it. I don't have any actual examples, but they just go to a different level, and they, you know, they say people use a very small percent of their brain. Well, they use a very small percent of their other abilities too. It takes a little adrenaline and all to crank it up, and then they do it. You learn to live when knowing that around could come in and get you. And when you're sitting in where it's safe, you think that would just, I couldn't handle that. But when you're out there, your mind comes to terms with it and you're ready to do it. Mm. It's nobody knows what they're capable of until they have to.
Do you think that's maybe what helped you get through the Tet Offensive too? I mean, that's one of the most bloodiest battles there was in Vietnam.
Yeah. Yeah, it is. I mean, I'd had a lot of time in country before and had done a lot of things, but yeah, when I went to, I flew into Khe Sanh just because I was trying to get back to Da Nang and all the planes were going to Khe Sanh on a C-130, and it was shot up several rounds from 50 caliber machine gun. And we landed at Khe Sanh and unloaded the load. And then we took off, or we were going to take off. And the loadmaster said, the tower won't let us take off because we've got flat tires. And so a couple of minutes later, he came back and says, hang on, we're going to take off. There's rounds coming in on the end of the runway, and the pilot turned the radio off. So we took off and flew down to Tan Sanhut and landed on foam down there. And so that was a bit of an adventure. And then I happened to be going on R&R, and two other guys from my shop while I was gone on R&R went back to Khe Sanh to do some work. And their plane got shot down going into Khe Sanh. And we traveled off manifest. We just go and say, we need to get to Khe Sanh. Are you headed that way? And climb on the plane and go. So nobody was sure exactly what happened to them. And then the next thing, we needed somebody to retrace their steps. So another guy and I got the assignment to fly and find out, you know, ask people at the different stops if they knew them and if they had gotten on, if they'd flown through, which they had. But trying to justify going back after my plane had been shot up and then theirs had been shot down, you know, that it was, made you nervous. But I flew around a lot on planes, and that was the only one that got shot up. So we, I justified it and got through it.
Maybe you did pick the right one, that yep. being in the airman or being an airman. Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. It. I went through my whole time thinking, okay, now I have been scared, and then maybe a week, maybe 2 weeks later, now I have been scared, and it just kept escalating, because every time I thought I'd seen as much as I was going to see, there was something else that came up.
So now nothing scares you?
Oh, now some things do, but
it'd be hard to compete with Vietnam.
Well, I came closer with health problems about 10 years ago, and it gives you a different attitude. You see, you know, it's no big thing, you know. And I'd coped with death from Vietnam and then with that. So it doesn't make me bold and foolish, but it makes me not too concerned about what happens. You know, I've always had kind of an attitude about life anyway.
Did you lose a lot of friends over there?
We had a shop with 12 people, and we lost two. That's Rios and Anselmo. They were the ones shot down. I didn't know Noel Rios really well, but Bill Anselmo was... I had been stationed in Denver, and then he had lived in Denver when he came in. I had about 6 months there, and he came in, and he was quite nervous at the time, and I showed him how to travel around in country, and we swapped a lot of lies about Denver and everything, so we got to be fairly close. And so when he went down, that was kind of rough. And As I say, I was kind of a student of such things, of what motivates people and all. And I realized, I stopped and looked at my own feelings. And I realized that one of the big things with a lot of people, and you hear the people that survived say, it should have been me. Okay, what I realized, because I took it out and played with it when I thought it, was that you go to war, you have to have a survival instinct. You put your buddies very high, but you have to put yourself a little bit higher. You're not going to help your buddies if you get careless and you die. Well, that survival instinct means that when somebody that you know gets killed, that little instant you think, I'm glad that wasn't me, and then you're ashamed and you bury it. Once it's buried, you don't dig it up again, but it gets you the rest of your life. And just the knowing that you had a natural reaction can a lot of times release people. It's some of the people I've talked to have been that way. I worked with a guy that said, well, I probably won't be in for about a week. And I asked him what. And he said, he told me his story and that it should have been him. And he was usually laid drunk for a week during that. I explained that to him and he came to work.
So what you're looking at there is they don't realize that other people have that feeling.
They don't take it out and look at it. That's buried so deep because they're so ashamed that they don't. They say it should have been me. What they're really saying is I shouldn't have thought it shouldn't. I'm glad it wasn't me, and so they don't even realize that exactly where that comes from.
Do you talk a lot with your former soldiers, Vietnam soldiers in particular? Do you draw these emotions? Do you try to?
Well, of course, I don't see any of the people I served with because the Air Force is different than the Army, where people went in groups and stayed together. Air Force was one at a time. And once in a while, I'm in contact with George Zafuto in New York, who was my closest friend there, but I seldom talk to or do not run into any of the others. Recently, well, after it was about time of the memorial dedication in Pierre, I was doing some research on the internet, trying to look up any information. I'd felt that I should have tried to contact Rios and Anselmo's family when I got back, but I couldn't do it. And so I started digging and trying to find any relatives to tell their story because it never really got out because there was no real records. And so I ran into a son of Rios, who had his name changed. I mean, his mother remarried, and they changed his name. And I saw, finally on the internet, I found a picture of a memorial service, and they had this guy's name, and from California. And so I looked up all and emailed everybody that I could find, or sent letters to anybody that I could find that was related, you know, looking for his son. And I did hear back from him, and we talked. And it was unfortunate. Back during that time, the fun thing was, the popular thing was anti-war. Hate the troops. And the way I can put it together, his mother married somebody that was anti, or she was anti, because she lost him. And, of course, at the colleges, if you were anti, you were good. If you went to demonstrations instead of class, the professors would carry you. If you wanted to meet the popular girls, you went to the demonstrations. Everything was loaded for the anti-war people. It was not popular to be patriotic. And so he kind of grew up not knowing his dad. He was very young when his dad left, and hearing nothing but bad things. So I was able to pass on some of the information.
This young man, he wanted to know about
yes.
his father, too.
Oh, yeah. He didn't know anything. I sent him information and a little explanation of why, because he was kind of estranged from his family, because he wanted to support his dad, and they wouldn't. And so, really, I put him in touch with George also, and, you know, just trying to put some of the pieces together, I explained to him how he died, what kind of a soldier he was, and all. So I think we helped him.
Mm-hmm. So you gave this young man an opportunity to be proud of his father for the first time.
Yeah.
What does that mean to you?
Well, of course, it feels good. Yeah. It's I guess there no great revelations on it. You know, it just feels good to have done it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, at least, even though I dropped the ball when I came back, at least I caught up with somebody, and I'm still looking. For unfortunately, there are a lot of Anselmos in Denver, and so I have not found anybody from his family.
Why? I mean, when you came back, did you decide you couldn't pursue it because emotionally you didn't feel prepared to do that, or was it just really difficult to find the information?
No, it was no decision. I didn't make a decision. I just made delays. You know, until I kind of forgot about it. I just could not, never could get together. I knew, I didn't know where I would find Rios' family, but I knew that if I started digging, I could have found, actually I lived in Denver at the time, that I could have found Bill's family, but there was just no time that I was motivated enough to do it.
I see. And you said it was the Vietnam Memorial dedication that was held in Pier. That was 2006, wasn't it?
Yeah.
2006. Mm-hmm. What was it about that pushed you to reinvigorate?
Well, it was. I started this just before. I think I started, I do a little writing, and I was kind of putting my head together and doing writing for my daughter's website. And mention of them, you know, kept coming up. And I've got the internet now. Maybe I can find somebody. And so I just started searching.
Go back and tell me about what it was like when you came back to the States in 68 after your service. How were you treated?
I can't say I was ever actually attacked about it like some people were. In a small town, nobody bothers you. But then I went to Denver, and not many people knew. One time I was in a bar with a friend, and I said something out loud about Vietnam, and he said, "Don't bring that up. You could be trouble." And I was a squirrely young dude at the time. I said, "Well, if somebody doesn't want to drink with a Vietnam vet, they can leave." You know, but fortunately, nobody stood up, because I was kind of a skinny little kid, too. So probably one of us would have left. It might have been me, but I never backed off. Oops, there goes the cannons
wow,
again.
That one was really loud this
yeah.
time, though. That startled me.
That's first infantry.
Wow.
But no, I didn't get a lot of the guff that a lot of people did, but I didn't advertise it. It just wasn't known. I changed civilian clothes before I came home because that's what we were advised to do. And besides that, I got my discharge when I returned from Vietnam, and I was anxious to take the uniform off anyway because I wanted to be a civilian.
Sure, leave it behind.
Right. But I never ran from it. I didn't realize it had changed me. My dad later said it did. I learned it did when one of my therapies was reading books about Vietnam. And my wife could always tell when I was reading a Vietnam book. You know, I was a little crisper, a little quicker doing things and all. You know, she could tell I was a little bit more warrior attitude and less family man attitude.
You slipped back into it.
Yeah, I just my mannerisms. I mean, I never had the flashbacks that a lot of people had. I think I had one, what you would call a flashback, but not. And there again, that was interesting to me. Wow, that was weird, you know, instead of it taking me back. But then I treated everything that way while I was over there. That was my survival, was, you know, hey, they can kill me, they can't eat me, you know. And I never took it that seriously until later, anything that happened. I always figured you laugh first, and if it turns out you should be crying, you got plenty of time for that afterwards.
You said that your father had noticed a definite change within you. Did he share with you what it was?
No. I asked, and he said, you're just different.
Do you think different for the worse or different for the better?
Oh, he played his cards pretty close to the vest. He wasn't that expressive. He was the kind of guy that when he walked into a room, things got nicer.
Take a break. It must be difficult for you to talk about your dad. Must have meant a lot to you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. No. Everybody knew him. Everybody liked him. He just didn't have to say things. When I was growing up, he never, very seldom told me I was wrong. He'd look at me and I'd walk out under the door. He could reduce you to nothing just with a look of disappointment, not anger, disappointment.
On the topic of anger, though, were you angry at the way that civilians treated soldiers? Were you mad that they were so mad at you personally?
Defiant. I don't think I'd call it anger. I just disdain, maybe. You know, I thought less of them for it. I wasn't mad at them. I just thought less of them, that they didn't understand. And at the time, I thought they were all what some of them were, which was just cowards. I came to know that the people that protested the war, no one knows except that person, and a lot of times they don't know whether it was a valid decision to oppose the war, a popular thing to do to oppose the war, or cowardice. Only they can tell you, and that's how I deal with it. If somebody gets in my face, even that's my attitude. It's just, I don't know why you didn't, but if it was because you were afraid of it, then I can't respect you. If you made what you thought at the time was a reasoned decision, then I have to respect that, even if you were wrong. But if it was just more fun to be anti-war, or you were afraid you were going to get drafted and so you were trying to end the war by protesting, then you don't get my respect.
Do you think that, like you said, you only had one flashback, and you've been very, very well off? I mean, you've been able to cope very well with your experience that you had. Do you think it's because you always, and I'm assuming here, it seems like you're the type of person that you've always shared your experiences and you've always talked about that. Do you think that was your therapy that really helped you today?
Well, sharing my experiences, but mostly I'm so interested in how people react, especially me, that I don't have the fear afterwards. You know, some people almost come close to getting a car wreck, and they think, "Man, I almost died." I think, "Whoa, I ducked that one." You know, it's just an attitude. It's anytime that something did come up, I said, "Yeah, that was really something." Not, "Oh man," you know. Yeah. So that's I guess wasn't born to worry about things like that.
That's a good trait, I think.
I think so. It certainly has served me well.
No, sure. Tell me, how much time do you spend talking to other veterans about your experience, or maybe trying to draw them out like the friend that you worked with, and help them understand that the emotions and what they went through is natural and it is normal, and other people feel the same way?
I don't get a chance too much where... I work with young people and old people. I guess Vietnam vets could be old people now, but a little older than that. And so I really don't run into a lot of them. I hope that some of the things that I write and such have get read and have an impact on them. And I'm always ready. And I've talked to a few of the Iraq vets and about things, and it's tricky because some people can get the other people's story. Some people, like my daughter, the people just pour their story out to them. I'm not one of those types of people, so I can just kind of listen for hints and throw in my experiences and maybe help a little here and a little there.
How valuable do you think it is for veterans to share? I mean, not just from the same war, but from across wars.
That is where a lot of us a lot of it breaks down. Is when we came back from Vietnam, there was a jealousy. That's not a real war. That wasn't a real war. The World War II vets and the Korean vets. It was a kind of much like inter-service rivalry, you know. They didn't want to talk, but they. So there was not really much sharing. It was grudgingly if it did come, when we had guys coming back from the first Gulf War. I happened to be on the city council at the time, and from the town I was in, there was about 5 guys that served there, and one of the other guys was a Korean vet, and I said, when these guys come back, and they'll be coming back one at a time, you know, they were still in the service, when they come back on leave, we should dedicate a day to them or do something to recognize them. And the other guy says, "Hell, I was in Vietnam, or I was in Korea, and nobody did anything for me when I came back." And I said, "Well, I was in Vietnam, and a lot of them spit on some of us when I came back. We should know better, shouldn't we?" And so we had declared it their day when they came back and gave them a plaque and brought them up and they talked to a group, tell them about what they did. And a lot of them said it made a difference.